Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me too. Lucy, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. I'm surviving. I'm not thriving, but I'm surviving.
Well, that's the first step.
That's something.
Yeah.
I'm eager to hear if you've made a start on the Cazalet Chronicles yet.
Yes, I have. Well, no, I haven't.
Oh, it's an emotional roller coaster.
It is. I'm just keeping you on your toes. What I've done, my conscience is clear because I have ordered it and received it. In fact, I bought it from the new, you know, the new website.
Bookshop.org.
Yes, which is supporting independent bookshops throughout the UK and the US, I think.
Yes.
They were announced this week, weren't they? Every time you buy a book, some of the money goes to independent bookshops because obviously it's a very difficult time for them.
Yeah.
So I bought that and a couple of other things. So my answer to that is sort of.
It does seem brilliant though, bookshop.org. I've bought a couple of books through that as well. And it's so satisfying to see the money going up along the top. There's a kind of a banner at the top of the screen and you can either, when you make your purchase, you can choose either you donate money into kind of a communal fund that is then divvied up between the member bookshops, or you can specify your local shop. I mean, they're obviously mostly closed now, a lot of them, but they'll be operating online. So they'll be working with the distributor and with this website, presumably anyway. It sounds like I'm doing some kind of publicity for them, but I'm not. It's just such a relief that someone has done something like this.
It does sound as though we're sponsored by them. This podcast has not been brought to you by bookshop.org, can we say. I'd like to ask you a question, Thea.
Uh-oh.
Because last week you said you were picking random countries out of a hat and making dinner from them. And I can't, did you have Togo?
No, I had Equatorial Guinea.
Oh, I don't know why I thought you had
that
Togo.
That was for the first week. I think
okay.
My husband might have pulled that one out, because the whole idea was that we would 4 weekends and we would pull 2 countries each at random. Mm. And I got Equatorial Guinea, and that was supposed to be this Saturday. But listener, I just didn't have the energy.
Oh, so I wanted to hear what you had for dinner.
As usual, just to move things swiftly on, as usual, I have been enjoying hearing from listeners with news of where they are and what they are reading. Nicola in Australia wrote to me that she listens to the podcast on her morning walk through the suburbs of Sydney, where she sometimes stops to gaze at some horses, which sounds quite like something out of an Elizabeth Harrower novel. And I can't emphasize really how much I like hearing where people are when they listen. I think it's something like a tonic to lockdown, this being able to imagine other places or something.
It is. It's really wonderful. And especially when, you know, people say, last week there was someone who went for a walk to the top of I don't know if it was a hill or a mountain, but it was like a weekly walk. He went with his dog. And I very much like the idea of Nicola just gazing at the horses for a bit.
It sounds lovely. I can just picture it so clearly. So do write in or tweet at the TLS to let us know where you are. We have lots of listeners in China, I gather. So hello over there. Nicola's reading is very on brand for us, Lucy. She's reading Critical Times, the history of the TLS by the late Derwent May, who died a month or so ago.
That's incredibly, I don't know what the word is.
Unbelievable?
Devoted? Maybe it's not because she's devoted to us. She just, you know, is, I mean, the TLS even, she just, you know, wants to to find out what's what.
Well, she says,
but
she,
I'm very impressed. That's all I'll say.
She says she's reading it for a university paper.
Oh, there we go.
It has so many wonderful. Yeah, exactly. It has so many wonderful stories. She says that it hardly feels like work at all.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is lovely. Leaving history behind, though, now and stepping boldly into the present moment. On this week's show, we have a roundup of the best books of 2020 as chosen by our writers. 65 of them from around the world. And here to present the findings are Toby Lichtig, our fiction and politics editor, and the man charged with wrestling this beast of an annual feature into some kind of shape, our history editor, David Horsepool. Hello, both.
Hello.
Hello.
David, how established a tradition are we dealing with in Books of the Year? Is it sort of up there with Orange and Clove Pomanders, or is it more recent?
I obviously don't know quite what you're talking about, but if Orange and Clove Pomanders were invented in 1988, then they're as old as that.
Right, I believe the Pomander predates the Books of the Year special.
Then. Well, we've established one incontrovertible fact at the beginning of our discussion.
Well, so this was introduced in the 80s?
Yeah, it seems to have been. It was, and it still was when I started doing it, grandly called International Books of the Year. And I think it may have been a sort of hangover from after the paper returned from a long layoff when the printers had been on strike in the late 70s. There was a sort of catch-up and people summarised the books that we had missed, as it were. And I had a quick look at it, which I don't think I've done before. And Thea, you'd really like to see it because it has a very strong Italian influence.
Does it?
Some of the people we asked, I believe Leonardo Sciascia is Italian.
Yes.
We asked
him. Well, he contributed to it.
Yeah, he contributed. So did someone called Gian Giacomo Migone, who's a politician, I think.
What did Sciascia choose?
Danilo Kish.
Ah.
Don't know what Migone chose, but get this, we also asked Giulio Andreotti.
Wow.
And apparently that was the second time he'd contributed to the paper. So we were always asking him. His favourite book of that year was Roberto Calasso, who I think may even... Well, he's certainly
well,
got
he
a, book
a book out,
out
at
year.
The moment.
Yeah, he's got a book out at the moment, Plus ça change. And I had a quick look. There are at least three people who we still ask now to offer their choices. Paul Muldoon, Edmund White, and Michael Hoffman, I noticed, were all
from the
in
first
this
one.
Year
wow.
And in 1988.
Gosh, you could tell a history through this whole feature, really.
Well, the sort of thing about nothing ever changing in the literary world.
But there
are a lot more people asked now. Because we're reluctant to drop people, because I suppose it seems rather rude. It's like not inviting someone to a party. So that's why the numbers tend to expand.
Surely the three people who are still being asked should have some kind of award.
A medal?
Yeah.
Well,
we should strike one for them.
Yes, that's a good idea. I like that thought. Ooh. I'll get right onto it.
Thank you.
Well, you have a whole year to organise, so you best hurry up. What are the rules, David? Do they have to have been published in the last 12 months? Because I'm pretty sure that rule has gone out the window.
Whatever the rules are, they're more honoured in the breach. I did start actually issuing rules when inviting people because people seem to have so little idea of what they were being asked. But when you're dealing with a bunch of writers, academics, poets, playwrights, they tend to make up their own rules. So what I ask people is to choose their book or books of the year, preferably published in the last 12 months, or in fact the calendar year 2020, I think I would have said this year, in any language. And well, that's about it, apart from a kind of request not to choose something by a friend or a relative,
which obviously again goes completely out the window. Lydia Davis begins, "I've read only two books published this year, both very good and both, I confess, by friends."
Yes.
But they do sound good. They do sound like good books.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, your friends and your relatives can write very good books and you are quite likely to read them, aren't you? My favourite example of that is, which he got away with, of course, is Ian Wilson, who I looked up because I had a vague memory of this. He wrote about a book that he'd read. "I felt I was encountering a very good English poet in the person of the translator. I admit that this translator, Emily Wilson, happens to be my daughter, but I am awestruck by how good this is and honestly would have said so whoever she was," which is so fantastically disarming that you just have to let it go.
I'm sure we've also had people recommending books and then saying, well, she is my wife, but I don't think that makes any difference.
Absolutely.
I'm sure that's happened.
Well, I like this year Raymond Tallis not only ignores the 2020 rule, he also recommends not his own reading, but his wife's reading.
Yes, it's a good combination, that, isn't it? Yeah. Is it not even 2020 his choice? I can't remember now, yes.
No, he ignores 2020. He says, alas, I have not this year read any books published in 2020. Tolstoy, Trollope and various works of philosophy have consumed all my reading time. Nevertheless, I am prompted to recommend The Mirror and the Light by Hilary Mantel on the basis of its impact on my wife.
But then he says, I haven't read it personally, which is a phrase I absolutely love. I haven't read it personally.
Yeah. That's so a very good one. Now I'm going to use that. I haven't read it personally, but generally I have.
David, has anyone ever recommended their own book or tried to recommend their own book in passing, perhaps?
Not that I've noticed. No. No, I don't think they have. I like this week, not in the International Books of the Year, but we have a brilliant review by Michael Wolff about Joe Biden, who refers to the days before presidential memoirs sold in their millions. And he can only be referring to his own book there, I think, when discussing books that sell in their millions about certain presidents. But in Books of the Year, we're far more high-minded and we don't recommend ourselves, I think.
Right, well, here's how we're going to do this then. I think we should go easy on ourselves and our listeners and accept that we're not going to get through the full 65 of the contributions, but we can pluck out some of the more interesting ones. So Toby, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, so one of the bags, the book bags that I like is Paul Binding's one by Roy Jakobsen called Eyes of the Regal, which is part of this cycle called the Barøy trilogy. It's set on this island of Norway and it's set during and after the Second World War. And I've just been very intrigued by this series. We've covered each of the three books that have been translated into English so far. I haven't read any of them yet, but each time I get a new review about the latest installment in the series, I'm reminded of needing to go and get stuck into it. Because it just
sounds, you could say, really, you've not read them personally.
Yes, exactly. I haven't read them personally. And I would personally like to read them.
We sort of do always come out with a bit of a shopping list.
Yeah, a shopping list, a kind of a, you know, kind of a enhanced guilt.
Yeah, self-flagellating shopping
self-flagellation, list. Self-flagellation, exactly. And then the next choice is David Bromwich's one, and he's picked out this book by Frederick de Boer called The Cult of Smart. And it's more the kind of the theme that I'm very interested in. It's essentially about meritocracy and about how we are disproportionately rewarding people in our society who are very good at getting ahead in certain intellectual ways and passing exams and jumping through the right hoops, but how we need to completely rethink this. And there's actually a very good piece by Paul Collier about this in our paper about 4 or 5 weeks ago. And he himself has picked out a book which he reviewed in that piece called The Tyranny of Merit by Michael Sandel, which is about a very similar subject. And he also reviewed David Goodhart's new book, Hand, Head, Heart, which is about a very similar subject. And all of these are building on the very famous book by Michael Young, The Rise of the Meritocracy, which was published about 60 years ago, I think. David might be able to give me an exact date, I don't know. But it's a theme that seems to be being built on a lot at the moment. And I think it seems and sounds very important. David Bromwich refers to the radical honesty of this essentially socialist proposal that bad remedies like the abolition of admissions tests and the increase of the therapeutic layer in college administrations would be rendered unnecessary by a reappraisal of it all. And it seems like it's very much a topic for our times. Mm. So that's David Bromwich's. And then there was this other book that, this is Gabriel Josipovici's choice. He's chosen Black Wave by Kim Gattas, who's the former BBC Middle East correspondent. And it was one of those books that sort of slightly passed me by. I'd read a bit about it, but hadn't really, it just sort of dropped off my radar. And it just sounds really, really interesting. It's about, he refers to it as the finest book I've ever read on the horrors that have overwhelmed the Middle East in the past 40 years. And I've been getting a bit obsessed recently by this BBC series, Once Upon a Time in Iraq. I don't know if anyone else.
Oh, it's so good.
It is so brilliant. Really, really brilliant. I think we're 4 episodes in. And of course, Black Wave takes in far more than the horrors of the Second Iraq War. It's about everything from, you know, the Khashoggi killing to Lebanon, Pakistan, Ethiopia, Turkey. But it just sounds like a really interesting panoptic view of everything that's gone so wrong in that region. sort of over the course of my lifetime.
Yeah, and he says, in order not to get too depressed by Black Wave, I would suggest reading it in tandem with the Penguin Book of Ulipo, Philip Terry's rich anthology of Ulipo writings. From Rabelais to Perec.
Yes.
He says it's a salutary reminder, yes, that laughter and linguistic dexterity, which I can't even say, linguistic dexterity, are as much part of what it means to be human as violence and greed. That's a book also mentioned by Mark Ford, in fact. So something about 2020 also seems to be sending us in the direction of Ulipo.
Exactly. And, you know,
if ever we weren't headed in that direction.
Yes, if ever we were. And, you know, with a vaccine possibly on the horizon, and depending on your politics, a fortuitous change of government in the States, perhaps there is a bit of optimism coming at the end of this year, and perhaps reading Ulipo after Black Wave is a kind of way of paralleling that.
Mm-hmm. Lucy, tell us about your contribution, which contributions you most enjoyed.
Well, one of the ones that leapt out at me was recommended by Lisa Hilton, who, of course, wrote a TLS book for us. Is that a plug? I don't have anything.
He's not your wife.
Not as far as I'm aware. And the book is called To Calais in Ordinary Time by James Meek. And it's a story of a band of travellers in 1348 who sort of fall together on the road to Calais. And she says he's created a unique language for his tale, a pitch-perfect rendering of Old English mixed with Norman French, which just sounds brilliant. And she says the language is amazing, but the pace and detail of the story are wonderful as well. And then just at the end, the silent companion of their journey is the Black Death. I just thought, I'd really like to read that. It sounds terrific. I hadn't been aware of it.
No, it does sound fantastic. It sounds like something that is just fully imagined and realised.
Yeah, and I really do like the idea of that language.
Yeah.
So I genuinely might try and get that book. Couple of others. Actually, Daniel Carlin mentioned a book by Oliver Soden, who wrote a brilliant piece for us about Michael Tippett, called Geoffrey the Poet's Cat, which is, you know, Christopher Smart, the
yes,
poet, who was spent a lot of time in an asylum. So for I Will Consider My Cat Geoffrey, it's about Geoffrey the cat. And I'm aware of this book, but I haven't seen it. And actually, I would love to read it. Daniel Carlin says, he says the greatest English literary cat is Kipling's Cat That Walked By Himself, with an honourable mention for Edward Lear. Hasn't, who's just written a book about philosophy and cats? John Gray, hasn't he just written a serious book about the philosophy of cats?
Is it cats? I thought it was dogs. No, I think it is cats. I think you're right. Yes, it's cats. Yeah.
He says it's charming without being twee, light but not lightweight, inventive within the bounds of respect for history.
Mm-mm.
So, you know, that's
what you can
good.
Hope for.
Yeah, exactly. And Claire Loudon recommended Ferdinand Mount's Kiss Myself Goodbye, The Many Lives of Aunt Monka. Ferdinand Mount, previous editor of the paper.
She describes it as part memoir, part genealogical thriller. Is that even a thing? And it is a thing. It definitely is a thing.
Well, there you go. And actually, I would love to read that.
I've already bought a copy. It's hopefully winging its way to me now.
Okay, good stuff. Well, perhaps I can borrow yours.
I'll pop it back in the post as soon as I turn it around, I'll get it on its way to you. David, who would you like to point to?
Because I've been reading such a lot of big history books and big biographies recently, I was looking out for slightly shorter, sharper stuff. And Craig Raine's recommendation of Matthew Francis's latest collection jumped out at me. Wing, it's called. And Craig Raine's, I think, is incapable of entirely praising something. He's far too critically rigorous. So he says, something pedantically completist, to my taste, fractionally overdetermined. But then he quotes things from particularly the sort of nature poetry of Matthew Francis. I love the fact that he's come up with a new collective noun for seagulls, which is a pillage of seagulls, which I liked very much. And then this sounded very right to me, having just after Bonfire Night been waving round sparklers with children. He describes two sparklers metal kiss till the magma bead at the centre brightens, showering the garden with sparrow claws of light, which I thought was absolutely fantastic. So that very much appealed to me. And the last one that I really want to get hold of, which is sort of making up for something I missed out on. We had tickets booked, my wife and I, to see Artemisia at the yes. National Gallery. And Elizabeth Lowry, who reviewed it, who wrote a very good review in the Times Literary Supplement of the exhibition, recommends the catalogue. I like the sound of the catalogue because she says it's completely kind of jargon free.
Well, David, you might be interested to know that Elizabeth Lowry did in fact join us on the podcast whenever it was about a month ago, and she talked to us about it then as well. And it does sound incredible. I was on the cusp of booking tickets myself, and I didn't. But I'm wondering what will happen, whether places that have exhibitions like that on will kind of restart the clock, you know, set it back by a month to make up for the fact that lockdown has cut into the amount of time that people had.
It does seem as though a lot of the major ones are being able to postpone the closing times.
Oh, good.
Generally, I think. I mean, presumably the international calendar of lending and what goes where has completely gone up the spout anyway. So I think everyone is having to react, well, as is everybody is. Everyone's having to react pretty nimbly to, you know, new circumstances as they arise.
A dance. I'm struck by the amount of poetry actually mentioned this year. Apart from Craig Raine, a number of other people have recommended poetry collections. I wonder if there seems to be more than in other years, does there?
Maybe, that might be right. I mean, I was surprised. I had to double check, for example, that I had ascribed the right contribution to Richard Davenport Hines, who I think of more as a historian and biographer, but he's recommended more than one collection of poetry this year. I just had to sort of check that I hadn't, you know, given his contribution, given a poet's contribution to him, as it were, but it definitely is Richard Davenport Hines who chose Martha Sprackland and mentions Derek Mahon and talks about gallery press in Ireland and the Kabul Olympics, a book by John McAuliffe.
Well, he's certainly one of the, his is certainly one of the contributions I was most drawn to, that Martha Sprackland poetry book, their Citadel. It's published by Liverpool University Press, I think. He says, I've returned over and over again to this little work of perfect art. The language is so lithe, exact and rich. The painterly images such a joy. The sensibility so fine and rare. It just sounds, he says that it's reminiscent of Elizabeth Bishop, which is pretty high praise, I would think.
What were your other ones, Thea? We have to ask you as well as that.
Well, yeah, I think I sort of was pulled in by the poetry. Beverly B. Brahick's recommendation of Evan Boland's The Historians, that was published by Carcanet, I think about a week ago. It was in press when Boland died quite suddenly in April. It was a stroke. She was only 75. Beverly says, history of the overlooked is a constant in Boland, but I think it's a sense of place that haunts me. And I have to agree. I mean, her poems about the famine roads in Ireland, they never left me. Beverly quotes from a poem beginning, I was born in a place where rain is second nature, and I won't read the rest of it, but there's this beautiful kind of solace in bad weather and the constancy of it, a sense that really these people in this particular corner of the world in Ireland have been chosen, almost blessed by the rain's loyalty, which is quite a healthy way of looking at weather, I think. But this volume, The Historians, it's kind of presented as the culmination of Evan Boland's distinctive blending of legend and history and the life of ordinary women. As the title poem sort of sums it up, there's a line, say the word history, I see your mother, mine, their hands are full of words. So yes, that's on my list. I like Margaret Drabble's recommendation because it does what Toby was saying before. It sort of trips you up and makes you feel guilty about things that you've been meaning to read for at least, you know, 12 months. So Tsitsi Dangaremba's novel, This Mournable Body.
It's on the Booker list, isn't it, that one as well?
Exactly, yes, it's on the Booker list. So I think we'll find out next week who wins the Booker. Is that right, Toby?
Yes, Thursday.
That's next week, Thursday. Margaret Drabble describes it as a powerful and wholly contemporary portrait of the struggles of Zimbabwe today. Most of it's set in Harare, but there are telling excursions to the homesteads of the narrator's childhood. And she quotes this excellent description, the nearby mountains have in the years since you last visited grown as bald as underfed grandfathers, which is an excellent line. There's so much, unsurprisingly. There are 65 contributions to work your way through. I chuckled at the wryness of Stephen Brown's, actually, because it was just so short and pithy. He said, in Simone de Beauvoir's Les Belles Images, a woman copes with her child's problems and with her parents' problems, with her own problems, somehow maintaining her balance through it all. Its concerns are so contemporary that one begins to think, it's depressing in a way, that nothing has happened between 1964 and today that has really mattered.
Yes, that's one way of looking at things.
Well, still to come on the show, in a surprise twist, which no one will have seen coming, we'll be talking about books. The editors here assembled will share their own favourites from the past 12 months reading. And if you have enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, perhaps you will consider subscribing to the TLS itself. Should you wish to do so, you will find all the options and details online at the-tls.co.uk.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi and I'm here with Lucy Dallas. Lucy, there is some new news on an old theme, a new statue in London. What's the story?
Yes, there is a brand new statue that went up on Tuesday, I think, of Mary Wollstonecraft on Newington Green, which is near where she used to live. And I think she set up a girls' school there. And it's to honour, you know, this very radical, very forward-thinking feminist. She called the mother of feminism sometimes. She wrote The Vindication of the Rights of Woman. And is probably now more known as the mother of Mary Shelley. But the thing about the new statue is, well, it was put up partly because it turns out that over 90% of the statues in London are of men.
Yeah.
And there's been a long campaign to put up a statue of Mary Wollstonecraft. So great stuff.
This has been it's been a decade in the making, and that in itself seems very surprising. But then not so much when you think about the first official statue put up of a woman in Parliament Square of Millicent Fawcett. That's only been around 18 months. And that was, again, a huge campaign by Caroline Criado Perez, wasn't it? So none of this has been easy. It's been a long and protracted thing.
Yes, it's been a long time in the making. And it's fair to say, I think, that it hasn't gone entirely smoothly because almost as soon as the statue was unveiled, people have started objecting to it on the grounds mostly that she's naked.
So if you what does it if you describe it objectively first, what do we see?
It's sort of copper and silver, is that right? Or silvered copper, something like that. It looks silver. It's by Maggie Hambling. I'm not sure if I said that. And there's a sort of mass rising up in which I think you can sort of see figures. I think the idea is that she, as a woman building on the achievements and sort of trials and labour of all the women before her, and she's sort of rising up out of that, you know, a very kind of inspirational idea. And this sort of mass is quite big, and the figure at the top is very small. It's a small silver, nude, female nude.
Well, it's not even her, is it? One of the criticisms is it's not even her likeness. It doesn't look like her. It's a symbolic depiction of a sort of archetypal female figure.
Yes, so that's a criticism and a defence, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Maggie Hambling has said, it's not a statue of Mary Wollstonecraft, it's a statue for her, exactly as you say, an archetypal female figure, and if you put clothes on her, that would limit it immediately. It's not supposed to be one particular person. It's sort of the idea of womanhood. And I suppose, you know, in a kind of art history tradition, of course, there's a great long art history tradition of female nudes. But again, feminists would say, well, yeah, there's a long tradition of paintings and artworks where the women are in the nude and the men have got their clothes on. And that's what seems to happen with most of the other statues as well.
And I suppose what it also comes down to is what a statue stands for, literally. What do people want it to achieve? How do you portray a person in their complexity and with their flaws? And if you do decide to create a statue that is the full likeness of a person, does it then become a total endorsement of them and everything that they stood for? I suppose the alternative is that you commemorate their ideas. And I guess maybe that's what Maggie Hambling's defence is, that she's commemorating the ideas, albeit in a way that hasn't gone down very well, and I can completely see why. But it's just an interesting point about the whether you create the likeness or you know and the entire person, or you commemorate ideas.
Well, and quite, and I mean, that's a very good point. And also, I'm afraid the statues where they just do the man, because mostly it is the man, or where they have done, you know, the man wearing the clothes appropriate to his time. I mean, they are crucially all wearing clothes, let's make that point very clearly. I think they just become invisible, don't they, after a while? I mean, as long as our notice has been brought to some of them recently, because they're celebrating people that now we might think, actually, we don't want to celebrate them. But just as a piece of art, very few people look at them and say, what a beautiful thing. Whereas the things, let's say, in the fourth plinth on Trafalgar Square have been pretty bonkers. But people had to stop and look at them and think about them and work out what was going on.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we all look forward to a day when we're allowed to indulge in non-essential travel and go and see this for ourselves and work out how we feel about it. Back to books of the year now, though. It's time to bring our own favourites to the metaphorical table. Who wants to go first? David?
Oh, it's me again. Right.
It's you again.
thanks very much. I have to tread carefully because I'm one of a number of judges of a prize this year of non-fiction, so I might sort of spread my choices around so as not to seem to be making any particular favourites, but I have read some really tremendous ones this year, including Alan Allport's book Britain at Bay, which is a book about appeasement and Britain at the time of Chamberlain and the late 30s, and you would have thought there was very little new to say about that, but he does sort of recast it tremendously and recast it as a sort of self-delusionary time in British history, and particularly manages to portray Neville Chamberlain as completely, absolutely awful, and yet somehow not entirely wrong. So he has personally no time for him at all. He's a sort of monster of ego, self-regard, wounded pride, and sort of unrealistic expectations. But he also points out that he didn't have quite as much room for manoeuvre as people like to think. But I've mostly spent, like a TLS contributor, spent the year, when not reading books that I have to, reading novels not published this year. So I'm not sure that I can be that much use for people's view of 2020.
Well, you can give us one of those, though. I think you mentioned unofficially to me, you mentioned the Topeka School, that you were catching up with that. And that, I mean, that was one of last year's books of the year, wasn't it?
Yes, which I was put onto by our friend from the podcast right here. He's here today, like Eamon Andrews. Toby's brilliant review, in which he explains the narrator mansplaining his girlfriend into throwing herself off a boat, and I was so intrigued by that description.
It's the opening scene, isn't it?
Yes, I had to go out again. It's filled with this kind of tension that builds and builds and builds throughout it, despite on the surface not actually that much going on. I loved it, actually.
I very much agree. I think it was quite underrated and underappreciated by various critics. I won't name names, but I think I really liked Ben Lerner's first two novels, but they were quite sort of interior and, you know, sort of man wanders around city and has thoughts. But actually this had much more, as you say, building tension, narrative drive. And I don't think enough people quite got that.
A lot of people sort of got stuck on the, or kind of tripped up on the politics of it, didn't they?
Yeah. I think he deals with politics brilliantly, though. This sort of, there's this running, I mean, we won't go into too many details, but this running metaphor of the debating team and the spread, which is you kind of basically you try and win a debate, not kind of basically with rhetorical tricks by drowning out your opponent with this sea of spurious argument. And that becomes a metaphor for our contemporary political discourse. And it's done very, very cleverly. I think it was very much my favourite novel of 2019. And I think it could be our favourite novel of 2020 as well, if anyone wants to do that.
Two for the price of one.
Why not? it's the kind of novel I think Frederick Raphael is talking about when he writes in this year's Books of the Year. He sort of has a dig and he says, the novel has been subjected to so much disfiguring rejuvenation that it is a pleasure to come on two handsome instances of the traditional form with a wide variety of characters by authors at once self-effacing and omniscient. And he goes on to recommend William Boyd, his new novel Trio, and Miroir de nos peines by Pierre Lemaitre. But he's very much having a dig at autofiction.
Yes. What did you call it? Rejuvenation? Disfiguring rejuvenation.
Yes, so much a disfiguring rejuvenation. Right. he does not approve.
Okay.
Toby, as fiction editor and politics editor, you sort of have to be all over reality as well as people's wildest imaginations. I mean, you must be knackered.
Well, it's all lies, isn't it? So it's all melds into one category. For my novel, I am going to choose some disfiguring first-person fiction, which isn't quite auto-fiction. It's a very, very intriguing book by a debut novelist called Gabriel Krauser called Who They Was. We reviewed it in the paper a couple of months ago. And it got onto the Booker long list, but it didn't make the short list. And I think there was so much of a sort of hullabaloo about Hilary Mantel not making it off the long list onto the short list. No one really noticed the fact that Krauser didn't make it through. And perhaps other people didn't think it was quite as good as I was, as I did and as I do. But I think it's extraordinary. It's written in this gangland patois, which, you know, it's a difficult thing to do to kind of make it stand up and for the voice to not waver, and it doesn't waver, and you sort of have to hit the rhythm of it. It's a bit, you know, it's a bit like an Irvine Welsh's Trainspotting or an Anthony Burgess's Clockwork Orange, except I think this patois, more like Irvine Welsh, isn't, you know, it isn't made up. It's very much how the characters did and do speak in real life. And it features this very morally dubious gangster character, who is Gabriel Krause. He's called Gabriel in it. What's one of the things that's extraordinary about it is that there's very little sense of guilt that the character feels for the life which he's recently left behind. It's quite ethically troubling, the whole thing. I mean, it's very well plotted, it's very pacey, it's funny, it's violent, but the actual ethical core is something I still haven't quite got my head around. And there's this very interesting disjunction between the narrator, who's sort of just left this life behind him, maybe one or two years ago, and still hankers after it, and the actual novelist, whose picture can be seen on the jacket, the jacket flap, aged 10 years older than the narrator, saying, oh, Gabriel Krauser used to be in gangs in London and he's left that world behind him. And the sort of gap between the fictional narrator and the novelist as cast in the packaging of the book is where that ethics lies. And you're sort of in that gap throughout the whole novel. And it's very, it's just incredibly well done. And it's, you know, it's an extremely gripping read as well.
Anything else that you'd like to alert us to? Anything else that you've particularly...
Well, very briefly, I won't go into the details because we've actually discussed it on this podcast before, but one of the other book of contenders, Shuggie Bain, which I reviewed for the paper a few weeks ago, Douglas Stewart's debut novel. I really, really liked that. And that's still in the running. I wouldn't be surprised. You mentioned Tsitsin Dangarembga, Fear, but I wouldn't be surprised if Douglas Stewart won the prize. And I think if he doesn't, it will be Dangarembga. We'll see how wrong I am next week, but I suspect it could be either of those two. Away from fiction, there was a book I read just at the start of lockdown, and it's quite light, but I just found it incredibly engaging. It's by Mark O'Connell. It's called Notes from an Apocalypse. And this is basically about doomsday preppers, people who are getting ready for the end of the world, either in their bunkers, you know, in the middle of the American desert, or tech billionaires, you know, setting up estates in New Zealand where they hope to flee once climate change really begins to make life unbearable around much of the globe. And it's particularly peculiar reading this at the start of the pandemic. I mean, he discusses his anxieties for the world. He's got young children, which has sort of made him reappraise his existence slightly. And he discusses the threats to humanity, including pandemics. You know, he wrote this well before COVID-19, and it was just quite salient to read it at the time. And there's quite a lot of interesting sort of internalizing and I guess philosophizing about our place in the world. And he sort of has this fairly glib but not unattractive cold eye which he casts on the world. He asks at one point, why was it so unacceptable that humanity should simply run its course? I think that's a line that kind of stays throughout the book.
Toby, I thought you said it was light.
I was about to say that myself.
However,
that's your light relief, is it?
What do you mean?
However,
read?
It's very, very funny. And so it's all about, it's all about these kind of odd people who are prepping. But he firstly makes, not so much he makes sense of it, but he investigates the kind of selfishness of their actions in turning away from the world. You know, what are they, you know, even the billionaires who are buying these vast tracts of land in New Zealand and Canada, what are they actually, you know, how are they going to possibly live if climate change is as bad as they really think? And what he comes back to in the end, and this is why it is actually quite, maybe light was the wrong word, but certainly a heartening book, is that he kind of comes back to an embrace of humanity, and he shows that these people fleeing the world are doing it for all the wrong reasons, and how we need to come together to stop these things and to find a vaccine and to halt climate change in its tracks. And it's funny. There you go.
I suppose so, but also there's the inevitable realization that there's a prepper in all of us. I mean, I've already seen a run on pasta in the local shop.
Absolutely. And in the days when we used to come into the TLS office before COVID, and we definitely sat around and discussed our escape plan, didn't we?
Yeah.
but exactly. So he really appeals to the prepper in all of us.
I'm still not convinced that that's a light book. So maybe Lucy, maybe you can bring a bit of levity to this situation.
I'm slightly concerned I was left out of your escape plan. This is the first I've heard of it.
No, sorry, David.
No room in the pod.
There was a sort of secret office protocol, but not many people knew what it was. I didn't know what it was. I just knew there was one, and I felt reassured by that.
I have a sense that our former colleague, Ros Dineen, kept a written document of,
I think
of
she
who
did,
was going to
she...
do what.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just happy that she had sorted it.
I have to drop her a line and find out what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
Lucy,
are you saying what turning to light? I need some light relief. I'm an idiot. What have I been reading? I haven't been reading anything very uplifting, I'm afraid. There was a very good historical novel by a writer, I don't know if you've heard of her, Hilary Mantel. It's about. I was really, really affected by it. There's not many books that you live in, and actually two of them. The other one, predictably enough, there is one other one that I haven't talked about on the podcast, but also Lonesome Dove. I was really, really just sort of affected by it. Lonesome Dove, actually, and The Mirror and the Light. I couldn't read anything after it for a couple of weeks.
How did it affect you? How did Mirror and the Light, how did it affect you? What did it make you feel?
I started feeling a bit paranoid while I was reading The Mirror and the Light, and a bit jittery, because you can see bits of the net closing in. And also it helps that I'm pretty much an ignoramus about the history of this period. So I didn't really, I mean, I knew the massive basic facts, but that was about it. So I didn't know what brought about his downfall or how. And there's so many lines of inquiry and sort of threads that you can pull on. You know, and I was like, oh, I wonder if that, is it going to be this? And then it's not that, and he saves it. And I just found myself sort of, feeling paranoid and seeing conspiracies, because that's what Cromwell was doing. And he was right to, because, you know, there were some. And I just and there was also a great fear that it would not be as good as the first two, I think. And it really was. And that, and how often does that happen, especially the end as well? I mean, it's notoriously difficult to end, especially a great, big, rich thing like that. Very, very difficult to end. And the end was absolutely beautiful.
You wonder how she must feel after that, how Hilary Mantel must, yeah, probably knackered. A mixture of relief and aggrieved, I would expect, just feeling some kind of grief.
I think I read a thing about her that she wrote the end very early. So she knew that she dealt with it. She wasn't sort of dreading it, because she actually wrote that quite early on in the, I don't know exactly at what point, but she had already, she'd got that in the drawer, as it were. So she didn't need to dread it.
Shall I tell you what I've been reading, or does no one really care?
Oh, go on then.
well, weirdly, well, I suppose it's not weirdly, but I've been, Sarah Moss just seems to have really sat quite well with me. Something about short, quiet books. They all turn on this the kind of provisional precariousness of life, the fragility of social and familiar bonds. So I don't know, can't imagine why, but that really resonates at the moment. But I read Summer Water most recently. I think it was published in August. And I thought it started out brilliantly. The premise, so it's all these detached people who find themselves for different reasons in a holiday park and the wooden cabins and by a loch in Scotland, and the weather is biblically bad. And so there's the feeling of isolation and being trapped. And it feels like a pandemic novel, but it was written before any of this happened. So it's actually more of a Brexit novel. And I think it sort of goes a bit wrong. Toby and I have sort of talked about this as well. It sort of loses its way, the rhythm goes out of it. But I think what I like about it is that it points me back to Sarah Moss's other books. So this is my way of getting around the 2020 rule. And so we'll go back to Ghost Wall from a couple of years ago, which I hadn't actually got around to reading. And I think that is a better book. It's about a modern family living in a recreated Iron Age settlement. All of her books seem to be about kind of settlements and small communities, at the mercy of various winds, be it the NHS that's falling apart or Brexit or in fact, the first book, Cold Earth, was it Cold Earth? That was a pandemic novel, and that was from 2009. So she's clearly an oracle.
Yeah, she must be. Did she also write a book about Iceland and knitting?
Yes.
Oh, yes, I read that. Yes. That was jolly good.
She's brilliant. I love Sarah Moss. I think I completely agree with you. Ghost Wall's just brilliant. And I can't wait for it to be turned into a film. I'm pretty sure it has been optioned. And it's the whole setup, as you say, this Iron Age settlement reenactment and the kind of when it gets pushed too far, shall we say, without giving away any of the ending, works brilliantly. You know, I really liked, I think you did as well, Thea, her previous book as well, The Tidal Zone?
The Tidal Zone,
The Tidal
yes.
Zone, yeah. A quieter book, but really powerful as well.
And hold on, one because I've taken us back. I've ridden roughshod over the rules.
You really have.
David.
You started out by asking
us back
what the rules were.
Well, I wondered, you talking about Sarah Moss, does that at all chime with Ali Smith's recent novels, which are obviously kind of driven by contemporary preoccupations? And I've only read the first of that. It's quartet, isn't it? Obviously, because they're seasonal. Which I think has now come to an end.
It has, yes.
Summer was out earlier this year.
And we had a brilliantly sort of waspish review of her final novel in the quartet, which looked as if it was really going to tear it apart, but then actually was rather full of praise once you got going. And it did make me think I'd like to dive back into that. I don't know if anyone.
Yeah, I read Autumn and Winter. Is that correct? Yes, I did. I read Autumn.
That's the way it goes.
That's the way it goes. and I haven't read Spring and Summer. I had more problems with Autumn than other people did. I found it quite slight. Winter's very good. There's just a little bit more narrative to it. But it sounds like Summer's the best one. And not only is it the best one, but it completely makes the other sort of the whole series cohere It sounds like it's very much worth persevering with.
There is also an argument that Ali Smith's shopping list would probably be worth reading, I think.
Can I end with one more book, please?
I'm sorry, that's all we've got time for.
I just want to say something about Caleb Femi's book. It's a poetry collection, and it's called Poor. Have you heard about it at all?
I haven't heard about it, no.
So he's a filmmaker and he's a photographer as well, and it's something that I love. It's photographs and poems interleaved. And it's set, so he's incredibly talented. His poems are centered on the Peckham estate that he grew up on. So it's, you know, the kind of 1960s architectural dream that the British did so well, has long since descended into something else. It's the estate where Damilola Taylor was murdered. That's the estate that Caleb Femi grew up on. And his poems are just so, you would expect that it would be really gut-wrenchingly depressing and dispiriting, but there's this surprisingly bright energy to the whole thing. I just wanted to recommend that. I hope it's the first of many.
That sounds terrific. Yeah.
Any final thoughts before we put this feature to bed for another year, anyone?
Let's pick some funny books next year.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that writers are inspired to write funny books.
What, by us saying this?
No.
We're at their mercy.
I'm thinking more about the uptick in the world.
Yes, okay.
But I suppose novels and such like do take a little bit longer than that, unless you're Ali Smith, to turn out. So we may have to wait another year.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to David Horspool and Toby Lischtig. Thank you all for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week. But for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.